Occasionally, we need to take some time, look around at the world around us, do a little review of the news. Luckily, here at Issues Etc., we've got such an excellent stable of guests that we are able to call upon at a moment's notice to help us do that very kind of thing. One of them joins us for the first 25 minutes of Issues Etc. today, Uwe Simonetto, religion editor for United Press International. We're going to begin by speaking to him about the recent survey from George Barna showing that pastors, Protestant pastors in the United States, hold a biblical worldview. Well, just a little bit more than half of them hold a biblical worldview, but there's a bit of a silver lining here, and that is the pastors, generally speaking, that are under the age of 40 are more biblical in their worldview than those that are over the age of 40. We'll be talking about that with Uwe Simonetto, plus several other stories to deal with in the first 25 minutes of Issues Etc. Brian Gadawa joins us. If you are watching the paper today, Oscar anoints its chosen few. Lord of the Rings, 11 nominations. Master and Commander, 10. And then a few others. We'll be talking with Brian about the Academy Awards nominations. Then we've got open lines for the second hour of Issues Etc. on into the third, about 90 minutes of open lines there. I think we'll wrap up our conversation on the purpose-driven life. Plus, I'd like to talk about a few other things. Ellen Goodman, my goodness, is she upset? She doesn't like living in this man's world, I'll tell you that much. Watch out, Mars is rising in the campaign. President's positions have little room for Venus or anything she symbolizes. I'll share that column with you. There's a local story here about a high school student who on a local sports program ended a broadcast with the words God bless, and they pulled him off the air. This kid hails from the town I used to live in for about 9 years, Dupo, Illinois. I'll bring you that story. And then some more research, including the fact that George Barna back again is trying to get pastors and churches to answer their phones, and apparently they're not. He calls and calls, and no one answers the phone. We'll talk about that during open lines. In the last half hour of the program, Gretchen Passantino joins us. The Hajj began, this annual pilgrimage to Mecca carried out by Muslims worldwide. This year, a little bit different. This year, Iraqi Muslims can go. Because when Saddam Hussein was ruling the country, he outlawed the Hajj, or he restricted the Hajj, because, well, they'd have to go to Saudi Arabia, and he was not very confident about the prospects of people who left his country ever wanting to come back. So he didn't let Iraqi Muslims go. This year, many are going. We'll find out what this annual pilgrimage is all about. Gretchen Passantino of Answers in Action will join us for the last 25 minutes of Issues Etc. today. If you'd like to join the conversation, our call-in numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Uwe Simonetto is a regular guest. He's religion editor for United Press International. He joins us today from France. Uwe, welcome back.
Good to be back.
Uwe, the recent research on the part of George Barna shows some rather sad news for Protestant pastors and their churches, but there is a bit of a silver lining. Give us the lowdown.
Well, the silver lining is really that 58% of ministers under the age of 40 hold the traditional, the orthodox views of their faith, that absolute moral truth exists based on the Bible, biblical teaching is accurate, Jesus is by nature sinless, Satan exists, God is omnipotent and omniscient, and salvation comes by grace alone, and Christians have a personal responsibility to evangelize. But the sad thing is that 51% of America's Protestant clergy, only 51% of America's Protestant clergy, and a mere 28% of mainland pastors stick to these tenets of faith. 28% of Presbyterians, ELCA Lutherans, Methodists, United Methodists. In fact, the United Methodists have the lowest rating. It's only 27% of them holding these core beliefs. But as you said, there is a silver lining. The silver lining we've all known about it is that slowly American and I think Western Christianity on the whole is crawling out of the mess that we've been left with, well, due to the first liberal Protestantism that was imported from Germany and that, of course, went absolutely haywire here in the 1960s in the United States, culminating in the Goddess Dead theology. So the good story is that that the younger ones are coming back to Orthodoxy. There's another very sad aspect, I thought, and that is that whilst the majority of white male, of male ministers and white ministers hold Orthodox views, the views of females, only 15% of female ministers have a biblical worldview according to Barna, which really absolutely shocked me. Whereas 55% of white ministers do, very sadly, only 39% of the senior, this is, we're talking senior ministers now, of senior black ministers, which I think is very, very sad.
And this biblical worldview, as it is laid out by George Barna for the purposes of his research, Uwe, is really rather minimalistic.
I mean, you know, you're not going to get into the tailor-made business. I mean, this is, you know, this sort of basic Woolworth type stuff, but it's essential. I mean, you know, it's something that in another generation, everybody on the street corner would affirm.
Now, one place to lay the blame for this, if we're going to lay blame any place, it seems the likeliest place would be the academy, be in particular the seminary. Tell us what's happened in American seminaries that can leave us with barely one half of a Protestant pastors affirming a minimalistic biblical worldview.
Well, the American seminaries, I think, followed the German 19th century lead in taking an anthropocentric view of a man-centered view of religion. I mean, you can shape your own religion. Everything has to make sense in a rational sort of way. And everything has to fit your fads. I mean, I can remember, you know, as you know, I've been to seminary very, very late in my career. And I attended one seminary where I stood outside an ethics class and heard the ethics professor, who is now a very high-ranking official in her denomination, say anybody who is against abortion is against the Holy Spirit. You had these kids coming out straight out of college, you know, listening to this garbage, no wonder they were confused.
Is there any indication of a turnaround here in the academy, the place where
yes, I believe
many Protestant pastors are trained?
To my knowledge, there is a great deal of a turnaround. I mean, if you look, for example, at Princeton Seminary, which is the biggest and richest seminary in the world, biggest Protestant and richest anywhere, you know, one of a Presbyterian pastor friend of mine said, you know, when I was at Princeton back in the 70s, the key issue was, what do I preach on an Easter Sunday morning, since God was supposed to be dead. That has totally changed. I think the majority of the Princeton student body consider themselves evangelical. The same thing I've heard from other seminaries, and the same thing I hear very much from overseas. There is a shift, but as Tom Oden, you know, who is a very, very fine Methodist theologian, a theology professor, and the leader of the confessional movement within his church, keeps saying, it takes at least another 15 years until all these types that have been that have entered the church and entered the leadership of the church, Methodist or otherwise, in the 60s, have been retired, and the new breed which is much more orthodox, or indeed is orthodox and very smart, will take over again, will take over.
Since we're talking about worldviews, you've written another analysis piece, Same Faith in Outer Space, recently, in which you kind of did a compendium of some theologians, their take on the whole issue of life off of Earth, especially given the currency of the news stories, the two rovers that have been launched and landed on Mars.
Yeah,
give us an overview there.
Well, the question here is what happens to two questions, really. First of all, does this have any effect on theology? Does it have any effect on the incarnation theology of Christianity? And number two, what are we to do with these folks? What are we to do with, for example, if we discover non-intelligent life, but some life there, are we entitled to colonize? Does Genesis 1:28, be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth and subdue it, actually apply to our outer space? And let's tackle the second one first, because that is really very interesting for Lutherans, but for others as well. Luther, of course, called man God's cooperator, and actually there is a more modern term as the created co-creator. In other words, we are partners in God's ongoing work of creation. This, by the way, is where Lutherans in particular and Orthodox Jews see very much eye to eye. An Orthodox rabbi and scientist friend of mine in New York, Rabbi Carl Veit, uses this term God's cooperator and indeed co-creator, and of course, as we are obviously under the command to fill the world and go to outer space. Of course, we are not to abuse this, and this is again where the Muslims share our view, not to abuse this, but we should go out there and explore and fill the world. So on that score, we are pretty much all in agreement. Then, of course, where we differ is the Christ who was there at the creation of the world, was the one through whom all things were made. What is his role vis-à-vis intelligent beings we might run into somewhere during the exploration of space? And of course, there the very strict Christian view, and especially Lutheran view, is you cannot have two different Christs. Of course, it is the same Christ, and therefore, if there is an intelligent world, then of course he is Christ and King and Master of the intelligent world out there as much as down here. The question is then, is that a fallen world out there or not? Is it a sinful world out there or not? And a very fine Episcopalian theologian, Gerald McDermott, also a friend of mine, says it must be, of course, that it is a fallen world, even if the individual intelligent beings there may not be descendants of Adam. We are nevertheless in the same category with the fallen angels, etc., etc., etc. So this is a fascinating debate that is going on. But what I liked particularly was, of course, the final statement. You know, there's a French friend of mine who is the director of the Paris Institute of Astrophysics, who is a Muslim convert. His name is Bruno Guidardoni, and he said, when I said, well, what would you as a Muslim say if we found intelligent life out there? And he said, well, que Dieu est grand, how great God is. That sort of sums it more or less.
I find it, I've given this some thought as I've examined various worldviews, and this is a great example to kind of lay before people and say, look, Here is a worldview that may or may not be in conflict with the biblical worldview, but let's compare the two. And if you lay out the fact that there's a singular origin to man, given us in Scripture, that it's a universal fall affecting all of creation.
Yes.
Man falls and drags the rest of the world down with him.
Right.
The express will of God to save all affected by the fall through Jesus Christ and the uniqueness of Christ's incarnation in human flesh, that Christ
has
actually taken a perfect human nature and incorporated it permanently and now eternally on into eternity into the Godhead, it's hard to understand any little pocket of the universe not affected by the redemption of Jesus Christ.
Well, you're precisely right. I mean, this is... This is pretty much what my interlocutor said. For example, Wolfhard Pannenberg, I interviewed, who is a German Lutheran theologian in Munich, and who is very much involved in the dialogue between science and religion. Well, he takes precisely the view that you are taking. So does Gerald McDermott. In fact, you're hard pushed to find a responsible Christian theologian who would not think along those lines, because otherwise you slip into a totally different religion.
Uwe, you've also written something on a story that was originally carried in a Turkish newspaper.
Yes.
About some 35,000 Muslims converting to Christianity last year in Turkey. You followed up on this story. What did you discover?
Well, I discovered that, first of all, that people, the German Protestant pastor in Istanbul, and other contacts that I've had, Catholic, etc., said, well, it is indeed true that there is an increase in conversions from Islam to Christianity in Turkey, especially in Turkey, but elsewhere too. Now, 35,000 is a massive number. Certainly you can't find any statistics. This may just be a sort of a balloon that Orthodox Muslim send off, you know, to warn people, listen, if you join the European Union, you are all susceptible to conversion. The interesting thing, though, is you have to look at the story a little more deeply. You know that there was a Holocaust from 1915 and until 1920s in Turkey against the Armenians, mainly Christians, with 1.7 million Armenians slaughtered. As a result of that, many of the survivors became token Muslims. This not only in Turkey, but also, of course, in Iraq, which in those days was still Turkish. They became Muslims, although at heart they were still Christians. But in order to avoid avoid persecution, they became Muslims. Now, of course, they say since Turkey, at any rate, is a laicist state, a secularized state, and now that Turkey is about to, or hopefully they think, about to join the European Union and will have to adhere to European Union standards, especially religious rights, etc., 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 they are reverting back to the faith of their fathers. And these were Greek, Armenian, Syrian, Orthodox, Catholics, and Protestants and others. But according to Milliyet, that's that Turkish newspaper, which has a very good reputation, according to Milliyet, they are becoming mainly evangelical Protestants. It is very hard to obviously ascertain any details whether this is true or not. The fact, though, is that that Muslims are converting, especially in Turkey, but also neighboring countries, to Christianity.
We'll be continuing our conversation with Uwe Simonetto after this break. In the few minutes that we have before this break, let's take a phone call. Herman is calling from Illinois. Herman, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Thank you for taking my call. I'd like to ask Mr. Simonetto how he appraises the current direction of the ELCA, given other outside events, the Episcopalian relationship, which I believe the presiding bishop of that body, Frank Griswold of the Episcopalians, has said if you're not promoting or standing in the way of homosexuality, you're doing the work of the devil. And I was just wondering, in light of all these things, where the situation in the ELCA, where does he see it headed?
Herman, thank you very much for the call. Uwe, of course, he's making reference to the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America, the largest Lutheran church body in the United States. Your answer to his question? We've got about 2 minutes here.
Well, my answer to the question is, as you know, that the Episcopal Church, because of its stand, is imploding and is falling apart, and of course being expelled from the from more and more Anglican provinces. The ELCA, there's a huge struggle underway, which I follow with rapt attention, that obviously the ELCA, if the ELCA goes the way the Episcopal Church goes, then you will have probably even more of a crisis, simply because large, vast numbers of ELCA Lutherans, including especially ELCA Lutheran pastors, are utterly opposed to the pro-homosexual policies of the church leadership in Chicago. So what you will find, many people expect a schism within the ELCA, and there is a huge resistance there.
Uwe Simonetto is our guest. He's religion editor for United Press International. This is our religion roundup. What we're doing here is just going through a couple stories that Uwe's been covering in the last several weeks. You were certainly invited to join our conversation, as Herman did just a few minutes ago, 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Before we wrap up this and go on after the break, Uwe, with regard to the conversion of these Muslims, would you give any credence to the 35,000 figure?
Not to that figure, simply because it sounds so highly unlikely. I mean, not credence. I mean, I would I have my doubts there. I mean, the figure is vast. I mean, if you have that, that would be a world sensation. It should make headlines everywhere in the world. But even if, you know, even if it's 10% of that, that already indicates a mass movement, because it is so dangerous for Muslims to become Christians. And I suspect it's going to be more than it's more than 10%. I simply wouldn't know. I mean, my contacts, both Protestants and Catholics, and experts on Islam tell me that 35,000 seems highly unlikely, and this is a sort of something that may have been sent out by conservative Muslim sources.
Uwe Simonetto is our guest. We'll be right back after this break. One more question on that when we come back, and that is, well, ironically, the prospect for the proclamation of the gospel in Turkey may improve radically if Turkey does, in fact, join the European Union. We'll get Uwe's thoughts on that, and we'll be rounding off our conversation with him, talking about, well, you don't think of the French as a particularly religious people, now do you? Well, what is the state of the church in France? Uwe Simonetto is our guest. We'll be right back.
Talk radio for the thinking Christian. You're listening to Issues, Etc. International human rights attorney and law professor Dr. John Warwick Montgomery on why he joined the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod.
I went to Cornell University as a pagan undergraduate. At Cornell, I was converted to biblical Christianity through evangelical witness. Then, before joining a church, I compared the various major doctrinal statements with the Greek New Testament. Amazingly, the Lutheran confessions fitted Scripture exactly, and it was a theology which centered everything on the cross of Christ. The Missouri Synod, with all its human weaknesses, remains the only mainline church which consistently takes a serious view of historic Christian doctrine.
If you want to learn more about the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, call our Issues Etc. resource line at 1-800-737-0172 and ask to receive a free pamphlet called What About the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod? 1-800-737-0172. 1-800-737-0172.
Now this Global Minute focuses prayer on a mission agency that's working with partners to broadcast Christ's Love Over Radio. It's EBM. Some dedicated Christians are using their radio engineering skills to broadcast the gospel throughout the country of Papua New Guinea, a place filled with many different tribes living in separate villages. Evangelical Bible Mission and HCJB World Radio are working together. Meanwhile, in the country of Haiti, EBM is in partnership with OMS International to start radio broadcasting that will have widespread coverage. They may not step into the church, but they'll turn on the radio and listen. Pray that these projects with EBM will introduce many listeners to Christ. Get your own missions packet from EBM by calling 1-800-804-9524. That's 1-800-804-9524.
Welcome to the Meyer Minute. With each year that passes, my fear grows, said David Hyde Pierce, who is known to us as Dr. Niles Crane of TV's Frasier. He says, my fear that the disease process that destroyed my father's and grandfather's memories, and ultimately their lives, has begun developing in my own brain. Alzheimer's. Love makes it even more terrible. My love for the people I know and the rich experiences I have had, all that I love, I am now forgetting. My love for this dear person who is experiencing what Naomi Bowick calls death by a thousand subtractions. But love also bears all things, including the heavy burdens of Alzheimer's. Sharon Fish wrote that she once got so frustrated caring for her mother that she struck her mom's old cane against the floor so hard that it broke. Now, years later, she writes, the broken cane serves as a reminder for me to be gentle with those whose lives are flickering in the darkness. This evening at 9 o'clock, PBS will air a documentary titled The Forgetting, A Portrait of Alzheimer's. A show like this will teach us more about the facts of love than most popular TV offerings.
Next time on the Bible Study, Nehemiah chapter 3, the people of God go to work, and it is amazing what the people of God can accomplish when they are operating inside God's will. The wall is being rebuilt, and we'll talk about it with Professor Reed Lessing of Concordia Seminary next time on the Bible Study, Nehemiah chapter 3. The Bible Study, weekday mornings, 10:05.
The Bible Study on AM 850 KFUO is underwritten by Concordia Christian Books and Gifts, serving God's people.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Uwe Simonetto is our guest. We're rounding up our religion roundup with Uwe, United Press International's religion editor. Uwe, we were talking about the story that came out of Turkey of 35,000 Muslim converts to Christianity. And while there's good reason to question at least that number, there is no doubt, is there, that if Turkey does succeed in joining the European Union, this will be good news for those who would like to bring the gospel to Turkey.
Yes, it will be good news for anybody who considers evangelism a Christian duty, because all my research in the last 2 years or 3 years shows that Muslims are, especially Muslim women, are very open to the gospel. It is going to be bad news for limp Christians. It's going to be bad news for limp pastors and limp, or what the English call wet Christians. Then, of course, under those circumstances, radical Muslims are going to supersede their form of Christianity.
The last story I wanted to talk to you about, Uwe, has to do with what you call France's Catholic contradictions.
Yes.
This may be a complete misconception, but my impression of France is not an incredibly, while it does have a long religious history, today modern France not being an incredibly religious nation. Can you straighten me out?
Yeah. Well, the thing is, both of what you said is right. It's a very secularized country, the most secularized country in Europe. However, the church in France, and here specifically the Catholic Church, is making the best of it. And that pertains also to the previous question about Islam. The French have understood, or French Christians have understood, that in order to confront the Islamic challenge, you have to go back to the sources and back to your to what being Christian is all about. And here is what I keep hearing all the time in my conversations with priests, and that is the word discipleship. Now, that is such a Protestant, such a Lutheran word, and that is now the key issue. And now, whilst the number of priests has declined, the Pope calls it alarming, has declined to something like 21,000 in a nation of 62 million, the caliber of all levels of the church, from the bishops on down to the laymen, is increasing radically, and therefore, when you go, for example, to my local village church here in France, you will find, in a wonderful sense, the absolute elite of the neighborhood. Elite not meaning that, you know, these are the snooty people, but these are the people who are committed, who have a sense of mission, who have a sense of being Christian, who have a sense of being neighbors, and they're wonderful to be with. And that is actually what is going on at the moment. I know a lot of French bishops, including one who may well become Pope at some point. These guys are the traditional pastors. They are no longer monseigneurs, as they used to be called, lords. They are pastors to their tiny flock, and at the same time, where there are no longer parish priests, and you know, here the local priest has to look after 40 altars, the lay people are taking over, including pastoral care, looking after the sick, all this sort of thing, greeting people in church, going counseling couples about to get married, looking after the bereaved, accompanying them, the bereaved. Actually, the dead are being buried here, giving a religious burial by lay people because there are no priests around. So what we have is a return to the primitive or to the early church here. And my German and Swiss and Italian friends are telling me that this type of attitude, which is not only Catholic, by the way, they play very closely with their Protestant counterparts, is spilling across the border. And yes, Europe is very secularized. But then, you know, if you look at the Barna figure before, and what good is it when a priest or a pastor does not believe in basic Christian tenets of faith. And if you just go to church because that's the sort of thing you do on a Sunday morning, what we're finding here is really a renewal, which obviously never starts as a mass movement, but it starts as a slow movement. But I've been following this. As you know, I'm very, very closely connected with France for family reasons, a long time, going way back into World War II. And I've been watching the developments in France, and I'm absolutely fascinated. It's one of the most exciting things to watch, because you can see bit by bit by bit how faith works here. And the discipleship issue is eminently important. Another thing I said the day before yesterday, I was at participated at a dinner party, and all these were committed Christians, some Orthodox, some Orthodox Russian immigrants, Catholics, of course, and I was the only Protestant here, and they were using Lutheran terms in talking with me. For example, Simul Justus et Peccator, the description of a Christian, justified and sinner at the same time. These terms kept popping up over dinner. Not that I wasn't the one who mentioned them, they were. So they are studying this. And you will probably find that in about 10, 15 years' time, you will find a noticeable growth in that type of Christianity, which I find wonderful.
And finally, this needs to be said, I think, against the larger context of European Christianity,
yeah,
as it is now being challenged by the growth of Islam,
yeah,
as a religion in Europe. Tell us briefly about that.
Well, it's being, you know, you have in France 5 million Muslims, and in Germany you have about 4 million Muslims. You have some, most of the Muslims are not particularly religious, but the ones who have the say are the radical Muslims. And so therefore, if Christianity does not gather strength or return to its sources, then of course the strength of the of Islam, especially of radical Islam, very law oriented, it will indeed be a threat to our civilization here. I don't think it's going to happen. I think it's the other way around. I mean, as the story from Turkey indicates to me, at least, there are people in Islam, in radical Islam, who are very worried about the Christian challenge to Islam, as much worried as I'm worried often about the Islamic challenge to Christianity.
Before we let Uwe go, we have one more phone call. Harold is calling from St. Charles. Harold, thank you for waiting, and welcome to Issues, Etc.
Yeah, I just wanted to see if Uwe knows anything about a stir-up in Welk, the state church in Germany, there, about a letter that appeared in the Frankfurter Allgemeine Zeitung of 3rd December of 2003. Mm-hmm. It was written by Professor Schleimann from Bochum. According to the letter, the Joint Declaration of Justification in the document that we had all been looking at and studying was not, in fact, the document that was actually signed. Instead, another document named in the letter as the Gemeinsame Offizielle Feststellung, official common statement, is what was actually signed by the representatives of the Roman Church and the LWF. And in the letter further claimed that the document goes far beyond the Joint Declaration justification, very much in the Roman Catholic direction, and that virtually no opportunity was given to the member churches of the LWF to discuss the second document prior to its signing in the LWF. And this caused quite a bit of a stir there. Uwe, are you familiar with that?
I am. I'm familiar with the ongoing debate on this, but I'm not familiar with this particular letter, Harold. And actually, I should be, considering that I am a Lutheran. But as you can imagine, with the Islam stuff going on right now, I was so preoccupied with that I miss it. Also, of course, I don't always get Frankfurt Allgemeine down here in my neck of the woods. But thanks for pointing it out, and perhaps I'll do something about it in one of my columns, and then we'll talk about it again. I'm sorry I have to be so evasive, but I simply... It simply passed me by.
I would be very interested in hearing about that because, of course, we spent a lot of time here on Issues, Etc. about 2-3 years ago discussing the Joint Declaration. That would be interesting for you to follow up on. And Uwe, I look forward to talking to you again. Thank you for the time you've given us.
Thanks very much.
Uwe Simonetto is religion editor for United Press International. He joined us from France for our regular religion roundup. For the remainder of this hour, we're going to be spending some time talking about the Academy Awards nominations. It seems as though most of the nominations went in one of two basic directions, either to the big box office hit, The Lord of the Rings, the third movie, or to the big box office hit, Master and Commander. And the rest of them got spread out, although if you look at the actual nominations, it is an interesting way to read. I saw it as a rather dry movie year, with the exception of those two big box office hits. But there were a couple others, namely one I want to talk to Brian Goodell about here in a few minutes, that being Seabiscuit, that also have nominations as well. Brian Goodell is our guest. He's a screenwriter in Southern California, and he's author of the book Hollywood Worldviews, Watching Films with Wisdom and Discernment. Brian, welcome back.
It's great to be here, Seth.
What was your general impression of the fact that 21 nominations went to two movies?
Well, the two movies were fine movies indeed, and you know, my own personal opinion is Lord of the Rings should win them all. And you know, interestingly enough, I from my memory of the books, The Return of the King was the hardest one to read, and I actually enjoyed Fellowship better. But in terms of the movies, I think The Return of the King was the best movie. So it not only is it appropriate conceptually for that movie to sort of represent the whole trilogy, but it actually is the best movie. And so by now, Peter Jackson should be winning, best director. The movie should win the best movie, and all these kinds of things, because I think it really deserves it.
I was thinking about this the other day, and if you look at other trilogies, they're so spread out, or at least in the past in movie making, sequels have been so far removed from the first movie.
Oh, yeah.
But this was different, and this has become kind of the vogue among directors and filmmakers to film all your movies at once and then release them in sequence. They did this, of course, with the Matrix movies, the last two.
Right.
And Jackson, of course, is famous for having dragged everyone down to Australia, New Zealand, and various other places and made them live there for the better part of 4 years to make these three films. In some way, it's like one big, gigantic movie.
Yeah, it's just amazing. You know, you just have to ask yourself, how much more, like, huge gobs of money and time and effort can they increase, you know? After Lord of the Rings, you'd think they're certainly not going to be able to top something like that in terms of the amount of money, investment, and all that. But, you know, I'm sure in the next 5 years something will top that, you know?
Then let's talk a bit also about Master and Commander. It got 10. Of course, the final of the Ring trilogy's got 11, but it got 10. Tell us about Master and Commander.
Well, you know, Master and Commander is an interesting film, and I wrote about it on my movie blog, which I have on my website if people are interested. I think that it's an interesting movie. It's well done, good action, some good values about courage, honor, friendship, you know, these kinds of things. Very, very excellent story. It has an underlying worldview that I personally don't agree with, but I really got to say they did a very did a profound, excellent way of communicating that worldview. They sort of compare and contrast a war worldview in one of the men with a, you know, scientific modernist naturalist worldview in his friend's worldview. And that's what the movie sort of does, is compare and contrast these two men and how, well, you know, the man of science balances the man of war. And, they do a very good job in doing that. I don't necessarily agree with that. I think that the man of faith should be the man who balances the man of war. But it nonetheless was done extremely well.
Now, these two were probably, with the exception of the Matrix movie, which we're not going to expect really anything from here, were probably the biggest box office hits in 2000.
Well, Seabiscuit.
Well, Seabiscuit, yeah, I'd forgotten about that.
Yeah.
But if I'm not mistaken, it was kind of like Lord of the Rings took all the money, and then the rest of the money got spread out among the other movies. Let's talk about Seabiscuit. I only recently saw this. I saw it in two sittings, which was very convenient because I think otherwise it would have just been too long.
Yeah.
But I was uniformly impressed with the movie. It was a beautiful movie, and it was a really gripping story if you had the patience to sit through it.
Yeah, definitely. I think if they would have cut a half hour out of it, it would have been much better, in my opinion. They just went down unnecessary trails, showing too many details, and it does seem long, and that's a death knell for a movie, you know. To think that you deserve that amount of time, you really have to be something extra, like Lord of the Rings. It was a great story, very interesting, good characters, fun to watch, you know, rooting on the characters. And you know, we Americans love the underdog anyway. So, and I'm all for that, you know. So I love any story about an underdog. The only kind of, there's a couple things about it that sort of, you know, make me pull back, though, is the bottom line is, as I walked out of that movie, I thought, it's this huge historical epic, right? And I walk out and I think, it's about a horse! It's about a horse, people! You know, and they try to make the horse tie in with the world and the change of the world and you know, making your life be, you know, all that it can be and all this stuff, you know, and it's just about, and it's about gambling, you know, which in my mind is at least dubious, if not sinful, but certainly at least of dubious character in terms of the influence that it has on our lives, you know, gambling on horses, come on, you know. So that I think that is something for us to consider about how a powerful, good story with excellent acting and characters and all this, you know, is it easily persuades us and we, our critical faculties are pulled down in terms of not being aware of the values that are communicating to us. That's something that we have to just be aware of. And I think that that's something that also takes place in a movie like Cold Mountain and some of these other films that have been released this year where, you know, they have values that are really not ultimately very good, even though the stories themselves are well told.
Tell us about Cold Mountain. It is notable because, of course, it was passed over so prominently this year.
Yeah, that's true.
What's the movie? What's the movie about?
Well, Cold Mountain is basically a story about a guy. It's a love story about a man and woman separated by the Civil War. He has to go off and fight in the war, and he's a Southerner, and he basically wants to get back to his loved one, his woman, to marry her because they pledged themselves to each other, and they're going to get married, Nicole Kidman and Jude Law. And it's about his quest to get back to her, but see, he has to defect from the army to do so, and he loses faith in the Southern cause, so that kind of puts all of us Northerners on his side, if you know what I mean, to root for him, right? But the fact is he's a deserter. He's a deserter, and ultimately, the movie is about human love between a man and woman being the highest value of all, and that living for causes and, you know, causes that are higher than ourselves is not valuable, which is really kind of ridiculous because if you think about it, of all the wars, whether you're on the northern side or the southern side, that was a war that clearly there was higher values that are worth living for and dying for. And so to make the claim that it's not worth it, all war is bad, and there's no real higher value worth fighting for, that's an existentialist value that I think is repugnant to the truth.
Lost in Translation, a film that I'm a Bill Murray fan, and when I saw that he was actually going to be making kind of this, what they're now calling a serious comedy, I assume.
Yeah.
About this actor wandering around for 24 hours in the dead of night in Tokyo, there to shoot a Scotch commercial or something along those lines, runs into this young girl who is married to a rich man, and it seems kind of a noir comedy. I'm intrigued. I want to see the film.
Oh, I recommend it for adults, of course. It's a wonderful little understated comedy. The humor is just it's intelligent humor. It's not the stupid humor that's in so many comedy movies, you know. And it's about two lonely hearts finding one another, and their search for significance, the loneliness and despair that many people have in society because of our desire and yet at the same time our inability to find human connection with one another, whether it's workaholism that, you know, or whether it's a hustle and bustle of the busy world or whether it's celebrity worship, all these things in people's lives keep us from finding just a human connection that we can know intimately. And interestingly, what this movie is known for is they never sexually consummate their relationship. And that's an interesting side that keeps the tension throughout. And I think it's one of the reasons why it's nominated for Best Picture, which is really amazing. And Sofia Coppola has really broken in with this. So it doesn't do that. However, the flip side of that coin is like the movie that Scarlett Johansson is also in called Girl with a Pearl Earring. Both movies deal with this notion of not sexually consummating this desire. However, it's still an emotional adultery that takes place in the film. And again, it's another an existentialist romanticist version of love that seeks passion and desire as the ultimate goal, not doing the right thing, not, you know, follow your heart, don't follow the truth. And unfortunately, it leaves one a person who wants to have a sort of moral sense to their striving for intimacy. It's not satisfying, but it does capture the lostness and loneliness and search for significance in a very honest way.
The last one that was nominated for Best Picture is Mystic River, starring Sean Penn. What's the story about?
Well, this is a very interesting, powerful story about three boys who grow up in the same area in, Long Island or something. And anyway, it's about an incident that occurs where one of the children in their younger age gets picked up and molested by some pedophiles. And they deal with it very classy. You know, they don't exploit that, but they just try to deal with how that affects these three boys as they grow up and how their lives become separate and come together at the end. And it comes together with a murder in the neighborhood of one of those men's daughters. And one of the suspects is one of the men who had been abused or molested as a young child, and so it creates this tension of, you know, did he do it or didn't he, who did it, etc. And it's a very gritty, realistic drama, but I think it's ultimately it's one of those movies that it ends on a downer, but it's one of those movies that's very nihilistic. It ends with hopelessness and despair, and there is no hope. And it really leaves you, again, in my opinion, morally unsatisfied leaving the film, you know, where it's a brilliantly acted. I think all the men in there, from Sean Penn to Tim Robbins to Kevin Bacon, they're just a brilliant acting and very strong writing, very emotional and powerful. But, again, I think it's one of those nihilistic movies where it leaves you with a sense of hopelessness and despair.
We have only a minute here before we go, Brian. You told us before which film you think ought to win, not only Best Picture, but it's 11 nominations. Is there a film that you have seen recently that you think is going to be great for 2004, or anything you're looking forward to seeing, with only a minute here?
Well, that... unfortunately, it's not enough time. Yes, The Passion. Everyone must see The Passion. If you're a Christian, you must see The Passion. And you must see it the opening week, which is February 25th. Please do that. And the reason why is for a movie to be successful in the eyes of Hollywood, it's the box office for the first week that matters the most. And Christians should be going in droves to see this movie. It's rated R, but it's only because they're accurately depicting what Christ suffered at the hands of the Romans like no other Jesus movie has ever depicted. It captures and incarnates the truth of Isaiah 53 of what it means that our Savior died as a substitutionary sacrifice in place of us for our sins like no other movie has ever before. And so please, everyone go see it. That's my big pitch. And I've even written several articles on it. They're on my website if you're interested in reading them. But definitely see that movie. And next time, if there's some time, I wanted to talk about the movie Monster, because that was like the surprise, powerful, profound film of the year for me.
I'm looking forward to it, and I think we'll probably have opportunity to speak with you very quickly in February about that and about The Passion as well. Brian Godawa, thanks for being our guest.
Great. Thanks, Todd.
Go to Brian's website, by the way. It's Godawa.com, G-O-D-A-W-A.com. You can find his blog, his movie blog, right there on his website, Godawa.com, G-O-D-A-W-A.com. When we come back from this break... oh, my goodness. Open lines lies ahead. Lots to talk about, some news, and a little bit more on The Purpose-Driven Life. We'll be right back.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.